Du lyssnar på Mona möter, en podcast som handlar om mitt möte med olika typer av människor. Jag tror väldigt starkt på att spegla oss själva i varandras livsberättelse. Jag hoppas att den här podcasten kommer ge dig ett verktyg på vägen, men också en medvetenhet kring din resa. Vad kan du få med dig i verktygslådan av min podcast? Jag hoppas att den här podcasten kommer vara givande för dig och ge dig precis det du behöver på vägen hem till dig själv.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to Mona Möter. I hope everyone is doing great out there. I am okay. So I have had a lot of questions from you guys that why am I not sitting and talking about Palestine? Can I invite someone? Can I have an interview with someone that we can sit and talk about this topic? For me, I am really honest with you. I'm very careful to discuss this topic. Even though I am from Palestine, I want to discuss this with someone that have a higher consciousness. I think that this situation is so much deeper than this. I always say that when we don't work with our own trauma, we project it on other people. I found this guest through his father, actually. Gabor Mate, I have listened to a lot of interviews with him. I have listened to podcasts, and also now I read a book that's called The Myth of Normal that he and his son wrote. The book is about childhood trauma. It's about understanding our trauma. It's about understanding our behavior and understanding ourselves and some tools also for us to heal ourselves. For you that doesn't know me, my name is Mona and I work as a CBT therapist and a healer, and I have my own studio where we combine Eastern medicine and Western medicine. For me, I found this guest through his Instagram and I really reflected about how he talks, how he discussed this situation. Welcome Daniel Mate, composer, lyricist, and co-author of this book, The Myth of Normal, but also the only mental chiropractor in the world. Hi, Daniel, and welcome to my podcast and my YouTube channel. I'm so happy to have you here. And for those that doesn't know who you are, can you tell me a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Well, thank you, Mona. Thank you for having me. My name is Daniel Mate. I'm Canadian born, living in the United States. So I'm from Vancouver, but I live in Brooklyn, New York. And I spent a lot of my adulthood here. I moved here in 2005 to go to grad school for musical theater writing. And I lived here for 9 years writing musicals. New York's a good place to do that. And then I moved away. I got married, moved back to Vancouver. I'm from. The marriage lasted exactly 2 years. I sort of kicked around North America in various places for a while. And then a couple of years ago, after some adventures, I decided it was time to come back to New York. So I'm here. I'm still writing musicals. And I also write books. I've written one already with my dad, The Myth of Normal. We're working on a second one now. And we lead workshops together sometimes. And I also do something myself called mental chiropractic. I have a service called Take a Walk with Daniel, where I take walks with people and help them get unstuck in parts of their lives that they're feeling stuck in. So that's my work life. I'm a musician, a composer. You can see the guitars behind me. There's a piano over there. Music's a big part of my life. And I guess for the last 2.5 months, I've also become something of a public commenter on what's going on politically in Palestine and Israel, with a platform that I never had before to speak about these things. And I grew up with an anti-Zionist father, but going to a Zionist summer camp. It was an interesting mix. So I've been thinking about these issues and, exploring them and studying them for a long time. And then when this all happened, it just felt like I didn't have a choice. I had to start just saying what I saw. And that's turned into a pretty time-consuming calling, which feels important in this moment. I mean, on the one hand, we all feel useless. There's nothing we can do. And on the other hand, it's good to feel useful in whatever ways each of us can that resonates with what we're able to do. So
Yeah, thank
that's
you.
the overview of my life these days.
Yeah, thank you. And I also have read the book. I truly recommend everyone that hasn't read the book, The Myth of Normal, to read the book. And also, I have been with a long journey by myself, healing myself through childhood trauma and stuff like that. And actually, I have listened a lot to your father and with interviewing and stuff like that. And through your father, I found you. And I think that, like, he talks a lot about self-compassion. He talks a lot about self-healing, as you all that you do also in the book. And for me, this is so much deeper. And for me, it's so important to have this discussion with someone that is have done this soul searching with yourself, because I think that this is the way we communicate on social media is a really like reflecting on the work, the inner work that we have been doing. So how did you grow up and how was the situation? Like, when did you learn about these thing about Palestine? And tell me more about that.
Well, like I said, I had this tension between having a father who had been a former Zionist and had, right around 1967, actually started to read up on the actual history, and his youthful Zionist dream of a triumphant return to the Jewish homeland for our people and, redemption in the face of the suffering of the Holocaust, which of course he was a survivor of, barely. His grandparents both died in Auschwitz. So, there was a lot of personal pain and trauma caught up in that. And so the idea, in theory, of the Jews returning to our long lost home and quote unquote redeeming it and redeeming ourselves and no longer being the victims, that had appeal for him as a kid or as a, teenager. But then, he also learned the lesson from the Holocaust that dispossession and expulsion and dehumanization should never happen to anyone again, not just to us. And when he learned that the dream of the Jewish people's national liberation came at the expense of a nightmare inflicted on people who had never done anything to us, he couldn't go back. He couldn't look at it the same way again. So I was born after he had already had that awakening, but he still sent me and my siblings to a Zionist summer camp because it sort of ran in the family. Both his brothers had been camp directors there. It was a left-wing Zionist summer camp based on the kibbutz model, which is not, that doesn't make it any less. I mean, I wouldn't expect a Palestinian to cheer that, like, oh yeah, you went to a left-wing Zionist camp. But we ourselves thought that we were peaceniks. We thought that we were all about coexistence, that we were representing the best in Zionist culture. We weren't racists. We weren't this and that. But there was just tons of blind spots. We were still fundamentally committed to the idea of Israel as a moral light unto the nations, of the Israeli army as the most moral army in the world, of Israel as a peace-loving country that was thwarted by the non-peace lovingness of all of its Arab neighbors and really never learning about the actual history of what happened to the Palestinians and why they were so angry at us and why they wanted to sometimes throw stones or resist and sometimes do more violent things, or why they just seem so miserable and upset all the time. We just never got any real insight into that, which means we never fully got the human picture of Palestinians as human beings. We're still looking at it through a Jewish, and I would say white, Western chauvinist lens, even with the best of intentions. So that's the summer camp experience. And my dad, I guess, just decided that we were learning a lot of other good things at this camp and we loved it there. So we would go, but it was a tricky thing for me. I would argue with my Israeli counselors when they would try to brainwash me. I'd be like, I know that's not true. I know it wasn't a land without people for a people without a land. I know we didn't make the desert bloom. I know these are lies you're telling me. And they were not used to this from a impressionable kid, you know.
And how
try to
old
put them
were
in
you?
Their place. I was about 13 or 14, and this is around the time of the first Intifada. So this is, you know, for the first time really in the 20 years at that time of the occupation, it was on, you know, it was headline news every day with Yitzhak Shamir's government explicitly, you know, responding to these nonviolent protests with what they called an iron fist policy, force, might, and beatings. That was Shamir's expressed strategy for containing the Intifada. So it was just obvious, and it put defenders of Israel into the position of having to defend the indefensible. And that's when I first saw it, just how morally hollow it turns us into. It turns us into very morally hollow people when we have to use our emotional, spiritual, and intellectual strength to defend the indefensible. Because we need to believe that we're the good guys. We need to believe that we're doing all we can. We need to believe that peace is just around the corner. We can't deal with the fact that our dream was founded on someone else's nightmare. So I could see it. I could feel the tensions inherent in, you know, the atmosphere. And I also saw the way that mainstream Jews freaked out at my dad just for speaking out. You know, hate mail from across Canada because he would write an article describing what he saw in the West Bank when he went on a medical delegation. And I could hear the pain in his voice when he was interviewed from there on national radio, saying he'd cried every day. I'd never seen my dad cry before. So I knew that there was something really serious going on and something really much more than appeared to be the case on the surface. And I just started seeing through a lot of the propaganda. But I didn't at the time quit that group and then go join some Palestinian solidarity group there was no such thing at the time, as far as I knew. And that was still too far outside my comfort zone. So, you know, I've been reading Noam Chomsky and Norman Finkelstein and listening to interviews with Rashid Khalidi and all the right people for a long time. But it was October 7th that woke me up to, I mean, so many of us too. October 7th and also October 8th and 9th and 10th and 11th and ever since. There's just no more time to sit on the sidelines because the scale of what's being done and the scale of the madness that I'm seeing Israel get swept up in, it's total lunacy. And I'm not Israeli and I'm not a Zionist, but I do feel a connection to those people. They're my cousins at the very least.
And from your point of view, what do you think is the difference between the way you see it and between what others see it? Because you talk about like how you grew up and how it was with your father. We have a lot of people here in Sweden and also talk about this never again. And for me, I also reflect on that word and I'm like, yes, never again to anyone. But this is literally never again to you because you project this trauma now through the Palestinian people. So what do you think, like, what's the difference between the way you see it and between what other Israelis seeing the situation?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say other Israelis because I'm not Israeli. But here, but right there is a very illustrative example of the understandable confusion people are having now. You know, there's a lot of alarm in the Jewish community and in mainstream media about the growing rise of anti-Semitism. And while I don't want to diminish it or say that it's not an issue, it's not Palestinians' fault that the country that has dispossessed them and is currently carrying out the worst massacre I've ever seen flies a Jewish star on its flag and sings about the Jewish soul in its anthem and claims to be speaking on behalf of the Jewish people and calls itself the Jewish state. The confusion between Israeli and Jewish wasn't invented by anti-Semites. It was invented by Zionists. And actually, there's a conversation to have about the anti-Semitic roots of Zionism itself, but that's a separate topic. So it's quite the point that I am not speaking for quote unquote other Israelis because I'm not Israeli. I have no Israeli citizenship. I've lived in that country for 10 months. It's a foreign country to me. And it's one that happens to claim that it's acting in my name, but I 100% reject everything it stands for. You know, everything it actually stands for. Some of the things it's claimed to stand for, like Jewish safety and democracy, those things sound nice, but that's not how it's actually operated and conducted itself. What makes me different? It's that lack of identification. I don't identify with that state as part of my identity. The minute you identify with a state and a government and an army as part of your identity, you're more than halfway towards excusing the evil that it does. And especially if that identification comes with a story that says, this country is the only thing keeping us between, well, the only thing between us and another genocide, another Holocaust. So I don't identify with that country. That's not what makes me Jewish. It's never what's made me Jewish. I tried to incorporate a sense of connection to Israel as part of my Jewish identity. I just never felt authentic. I wasn't born there. I'm not a Hebrew speaker. Middle Eastern food is not my food. You know, I don't want to lay claim to hummus. You know, like that's not where my people come from. Like my people come from Hungary and Lithuania and Poland and we're part of the wave of Jews who made North American popular culture what it is, musical theater, stand-up comedy, jazz, all this kind of stuff, you know, collaborating with African Americans and other oppressed people to create all kinds of wonderful culture over here. So Israel to me is a sort of a strange foreign experiment that I'm not a part of. And yet I grew up around it, learning about it, and was taught very strenuously to identify with it. Now, if you identify with something, then you're going to protect it when people criticize it.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a hard time seeing it from anyone else's point of view. And a big part of the Israeli narrative, the Zionist narrative, is we're eternally the victims. No matter what we do, we're always the victims. No matter what we do, if people hate us or fight back against us, it's not because of what we did. It's because of who we are. Of course, you know full well that if the Zionists were Swedish or Norwegian or Latvian or Zulu, if the people who had come to Palestine and did what the Zionists did came from any of those places, then Palestinians would be fighting those people.
Yeah.
You know, but the identification with I am a member of the Jewish nation and Israel is our country, it puts people into a state of moral arrested development because they get freezed up. They to criticize it or to really admit what's going on, it feels like to commit suicide because this is all we have. I don't buy into that myth. It's, to me, it's a false myth. It's a lie, actually. It always was. That it's understandable that Jews, after thousands of years of insecurity and precariousness and perennial catastrophes and the ultimate catastrophe in the Nazi Holocaust would say no more of this. I understand. But there's also a cynical side to that. I mean, Norman Finkelstein wrote a book called The Holocaust Industry over 20 years ago now. And that whole thing you're talking about over there in Europe, the guilt, the never again. Europe has reasons to be very remorseful for what happened in World War II. But that happened in World War II, coming up on 80 years ago now, you know? And sometimes when we get trapped inside of guilt, we can develop new blind spots about things we may feel guilty about 50 years from now, you know? And Israel, quite frankly, has cynically, and its supporters all over the world have cynically exploited European and white Western guilt about the Holocaust, which is why that whole never again thing. I mean, I never thought in my life that I would be tweeting angry hate mail at, or you know, I would be tweeting sort of angry posts at the Auschwitz memorial. But I actually sent this like very sarcastic reply to Auschwitz, where my great grandparents died. And I said, I never thought I would say this, Auschwitz, but I'm really disappointed in you. I mean, what a ridiculous thing for me to say. But I was. They had put out this statement in solidarity with Israel and the propaganda that would have made Joseph Goebbels proud. And Auschwitz comes out and stands in solidarity with Israel and their so-called right of self-defense, period, no questions asked. And I tweeted, I said, that's it, Auschwitz. I'm officially embarrassed that my great-grandparents chose your establishment to be exterminated in. And I was just like, it's just so disgusting because they're trying, this whole industry is trying to perform its allegiance to me and my people and show simp. And it's just, to me, it's a total betrayal of what the lessons of that place should be. So I really, really wish for Europe that it finds a way to shake off this eternal sense of guilt, which you'll never be able to pay back anyway. You can't pay back what happened in the Holocaust. The best you can do is to try and join the modern world and keep your eyes open for injustice everywhere and not be manipulated.
Yeah, and I think also we have a big problem here in like the government and how they present everything, how they talk about everything, and that's why we feel so frustrated because they always talk about from one point of view. So a lot of them, when they go out and talk, they say like, yeah, this would never happen if it wasn't for Hamas, the 7th of October. But the difference is that Swedish people doesn't know so much about 1948. They don't know anything about Palestine. They think that like, yeah, because when they have the government is saying like, yeah, the terrorists are like Muslim people and they did this to them. That's why, because I think that this is so much deeper than this. I think this is has to do with your consciousness. How much have you met yourself? Because you talk a lot now about guilt. You talk a lot about like what actually happened to you when you go through stuff in your life. And I also seen like on your page and on your Instagram that like they call you self-hating Jewish.
Yeah, that's an old standby. It's funny to me at this point. As I've said, I may be self-hating, but it's got nothing to do with my Judaism. My Jewishness might be one of my favorite things about myself. But that's the accusation. If they can't call you an anti-Semite, like they'll call you an anti-Semite, right? Because you're a Muslim woman, I'm assuming, right? Me, they can't quite call me an anti-Semite. So they'll call me a self-hating Jew. In other words, they'll like put me on the psychotherapist couch and diagnose me with some kind of neurosis. I must be crazy in the head. I must hate myself. I must hate Jewish people or hate my Jewishness or be ashamed of my history in order to take the position I take. When in fact, it's a complete and total projection. They're the ones who are harboring deep, deep, deep self-loathing. And I can prove it because the earliest Zionists, there was a fundamental assimilationist streak. They were ashamed and sick and tired of being the underdog, the victim, the outsider. You know, Jews have lived all over the world without ever being in the majority. And we found a way to keep going, living among people who weren't always welcoming. Many often were. If we look throughout the Arab and Muslim world, Jews and there are Arab Jews, and Jews and Muslims lived side by side, mostly in peace for a long, long time, including in Palestine, especially in Palestine. But where was I going with that? Just in
About
terms of
this,
the self. Oh, yeah, right. About so the origins of Zionism. You go back and look at some of the earliest writings of Zionists talking about the ugliness of the shtetl Jew, the ghetto Jew, the Torah Jew, the pale, trembling, cowardly, bookish, nerdy Jew. The European intellectual, artist, outsider Jew was disgusting to these Zionist colonizers who wanted to create a new master race of Jews, a new race of Jewish Ubermenschen, you know, proud, strong farmers, soldiers, tanned, attractive, sexy, virile, all of that. Now, of course, that's very much a European construct, right? Then you had all the Mizrahi Arab Jews who were already perfectly well integrated into Muslim culture. And that created a whole other problem for the Zionists. How are we going to drive a wedge? But the fundamental idea of Zionism, and you know what? Joe Biden said it the other night. He's one of the world's biggest Zionists. And he said it at the Hanukkah party at the White House. He said, without Israel, no Jew in the world would be safe. So what he's saying is, in my country that I run, the most powerful country in the world, the United States, where Jews are, you know, have the highest income of any racial minority group and are living pretty securely. No, they're not safe here either. And if it wasn't for Israel, there would be another Holocaust here. Imagine the president of the United States saying that. He's putting me in danger by saying that. It's a lie. And it's a kind of, it's almost asking for it to be proven true, God forbid. You know? So the self-loathing of Zionism says Jews are not safe or welcome anywhere, and there's a good reason for that, and we need to congregate by ourselves, and in the so doing, become just like everybody else, become strong and selfish and murderous and genocidal if that's what it takes. Damn it. We're tired of being the victims. We want in on the power side of things. Well, when you do that, my friends, you're rejecting what makes Judaism a beautiful religion and a beautiful tradition. You're trading it in for the golden calf that we were admonished by God in, like, what, the second commandment not to worship, you know, the idols of this world, the material things, all of that, losing touch with our morals, our spiritual principles. So as far as I'm concerned, Zionism and Israel are the single greatest threats to Jewishness in the sense of the Jewish soul. And that's even before we consider all of the horrific violence that that state is imposing and has imposed on another people, which then creates a completely understandable, if lamentable, backlash against all Jewish people. It shouldn't be that way. And I would love to educate every Palestinian in the world that, no, hey, I'm not Israel, you know? But also, that's something that there's something obscene about that, of me being like, oh, wait a minute, hold on, just be angry at the right people. Why should they? Like, I don't want them to lump me in with Israel. But it's not, again, like I said, it's not their fault that Israel has, that every Jew that a Palestinian in Gaza has ever encountered was flying above them in a plane trying to destroy their home or shooting at them from a fence.
And also that goes with me because, like, for me, when I grew up, my father, he passed away like 2019, but he was 1 year old when it was the occupation, and his mother when they left Palestine. And when I grew up, you know, my mom, she's like, it's so strange that people in Sweden are talking about Palestinian hating Jews. Because when we grew up, you know, when the occupation was, they went to Syria, to Damascus. And in Damascus, they had a street called Shari' al-Yahudi. That was the street of the Jews. And my mom said, she was like, I can't understand, because I had Jewish friends, we were hanging out. She's like, when I hear this, like the Swedish government now is doing, she's like, I can't even relate, because we don't have that hate inside of us. That's why for me, I have a frustration inside of me, because I don't hate anyone. And I'm like, hi, can you see me? I'm Palestinian, but like, I'm not a terrorist and I'm not hating anyone. And I think that that is a frustration we all have now in Swedish, being Palestinian people. And we try to, like, I try to see it in the way that you explain it. And like, I can't make someone else think like me and don't judge me. This is like about the individual by herself or himself. If he hates me, obviously it is something with themselves they haven't reflected on. That's why the hate is keep on growing.
That's true, but it's also because of a much bigger propaganda system they're inside of. And I, you know, because the media is feeding them, yeah. It's helping them think yeah. You're a terrorist because, you know, I can't imagine what it's like to be a Palestinian right now. And anytime I hear Jewish people complaining about how they feel unsafe on college campuses, it makes me just disgusted because, you know, even me, who's very sympathetic to Palestine and stands in solidarity with Palestine and wants to see Israel dismantled and reformed as a democratic country for everybody, I still haven't spent nearly enough time talking to actual Palestinians in my life. Palestinians have mainly been an idea. They were the sort of villain, and then they were the righteous victims, and it was all very abstract. But just what it must take to move through the world, a world that's so determined to hate you for no reason, but there is a reason. The reason is this: at least for Jews, for Zionists, they have to hate you, otherwise their entire worldview falls apart.
Yeah.
They have to believe that you want them dead for no reason. Because if you don't want them dead for no reason, then there must be a reason that your people keeps resisting and disrupting their peace and quiet, which is not really peace and quiet. And if they looked at why, if they looked at what was happening on October 6th, such that October 7th happened, the whole thing would start to unravel. And they know that. So they can't afford to. So they're pressing ahead, and the mainstream media and mainstream Western politicians shamefully are helping with this.
Yeah.
And it's character assassination on a national scale. And no one has had it as bad as the Palestinians. Nobody. I was at an event last night where an Iraqi woman who was born in Iraq during the Gulf War was talking about her experiences. And she turned to a Palestinian woman who was sitting in nearby on the couch and said, and obviously we don't have it 1,000 times as bad as you do. And if you just think about how long this has been going on, and the world's indifference, and the Arab world's indifference, and the, you know, in terms of the governments, I mean, you know, and the way that my people have continued to insist that we're the only victim, and the way that Western powers have used Palestine as a political football, and all the betrayals and all the corruption, and it's a tremendous injustice, and the martyrdom of your people, it boggles my imagination. And sometimes I have a voice in my head being like, who am I even to speak about it? But then I hear from Palestinian people, this woman last night at this gathering said to me, you need to keep doing what you're doing. We need you. You're doing your job out there. You're driving a wedge through your community. You're saying the things we can't say. And it makes me really angry that I can say these things and she can't, or that you can't. But if that's how it is, then I'm going to say them because it's the fucking least I can do.
Yeah, and I get very emotional because I think that, like, sorry.
Please don't apologize. I'm sorry.
Seeing your father and you talk about this makes me feel hold, because it's like, if I go out and speak about this, I don't have the same voice that you guys have. That's why it's so important for me, because I was like talking to my mom, because my father, he's not alive. I'm like, mom, I need to have this interview with someone that I can I'm honest with you, Daniel, like from the other side, like someone that is Jewish that I can discuss this with, because my voice, I feel that I'm screaming, but no one is hearing me, and I feel so useless. Like, yeah. We go and demonstrate. The other day, the government is like, yeah, we have so much anti-Semite now. They're demonstrating all around the world. And I'm like, hey, yo, I love everyone. So this is so painful
many. You can't win. You wear your own clothing and it's terrorist garb. You speak words in your language like Intifada and Ya Allah and words that mean deep, noble things like faith in God or uprising. These are things that we have words for in our traditions and we celebrate them. But when you guys do it, all we can see is the dark mirror image that we're, you know, projecting. And I hate to hear you say that you're talking to someone on the other side, because I don't want to be on the other side of anything from you. I'm just on the other side of some, you know, but I get it that, like, being born Jewish placed me by default on the other side, and I'm having to live my life in a way that brings me closer so that you and I are not on opposite sides, because I completely I hate that we're living in a world where you feel you need to scream just to be even heard at a whisper level. And it's, and again, that is the way it is right now. And I am seeing a lot of Palestinian people find voices on social media that I've never seen before. I had a conversation with two young Palestinian women.
Yeah, I saw it.
One of whom was born in Gaza. You saw that
one,
right?
Yeah, I saw it.
What did you think of that conversation?
No, I liked it so much. And I thought that, like, it gave them also, what do you say, an opportunity to talk about this. So I think this was... I'm so grateful. Like, I know that for you being this human being, and it's... For you, you feel maybe like, yeah, I'm standing on justice, but, like, it is so important. And the more voice we have, the more change we can do. Because what we see now is, like, we have had this situation many times, but I have never, since my childhood, see so much support. Even though
there's
I know, like, from social media, and you say that the media is, like, doing the stuff, but the people now are really awakened. And I think this is because a lot of us, the only thing that I'm very, like, confused and what I reflected about is, like, today we are so many people that are so conscious. We have this social media, we have so much, we read, we have, like, you can just open your phone and you can see someone talk about, yeah, higher consciousness, meet yourself, growth, self-compassion. And I'm very confused, like, 2023, we are still having this point of view that we talk about hate, we talk about everything that has been doing now. So I'm like, oh my God, we haven't gone so far.
Well, yeah, and then there's the phenomenon of people who go on Instagram and make their brand about healing and whatever, and they don't have a thing to say about injustice in the world, you know, or they say these mealy-mouthed things. It's called spiritual bypass. Look, we're living inside of a systems, inside of a systems, inside of systems, and the large system, which we write about in The Myth of Normal, is global capitalism, individualism, a very Western-centric view of the world. And it's a totalizing influence. When you're living inside of it, it affects everything. It affects how you think. It affects, and I'm sure for Palestinian people, it affects how they see themselves. They have to, you know, Malcolm X wrote about how he had to work out of his system the indoctrination, the self-hatred that was burrowed into him by American white supremacy, to hate himself from the, you know, from the top of his head to the soles of his feet. He wrote about that, you know, and encouraging other Black people to do the same thing. So we're living inside of systems that govern how we think and how we see ourselves and how we see others. And One of the facets of that is that there's an industry called self-help, an industry called mindfulness and meditation, and people make a lot of money off of it and they sell it. What are they selling? They're selling self-improvement, individual self-improvement, feeling good about yourself, making your pain go away, making the hard stuff go away, looking good for the Instagram camera. I mean, capitalism ruins everything. And Western imperialism is tied to it, and Western imperialism is a big driving force in what's happened to Palestine. So again, like I said about Israelis can't afford to see your humanity, because if they saw your humanity, they'd realize how inhuman their society's become.
And
Somehow Palestine is also this thing that Western capitalism can't deal with, because most of us colonized countries, Australia, Canada, United States, our settlers completed the genocide, more or less. Didn't kill all the indigenous people, but they relegated them to, isolated parts of the country where most people don't have to think about them. Israel never completed the genocide. It only got midway, and it was just sort of, it was an ethnic cleansing, but a lot of people remained, and there's a lot of memory. And Palestine is the memory that won't die. Palestine is the people's connection to a land that won't die. That's not about owning that land and exploiting that land, but it's about loving that land and being of that land. That's what indigeneity really means, not just having a genetic tie, but really being people of a particular place. And there's something about Western imperialist capitalism that needs to wipe that out, because it's a memory of what could be.
And I really want to talk to you a little bit about your book because I read it, and I recommend everyone that is watching this and listening to this to read this book, because it's so much to understand about your childhood, the way we think, the way we absorb the environment. And something that I caught up on was on page 24. That you mentioned that people are drawn to leaders, that they are like drawn to this aggressive
Oh yeah,
people.
chapter 20, chapter 24, the politics chapter. Yeah.
And then you had a very good answer on page chapter, sorry, 25, where you were talking about you need to admit your own pain to grow. And then you have this healing with the 4A. Can you talk a little bit more for people that haven't read the book?
Sure. Yeah. So the 4 A's, that's one of my dad's coinages. I think we've realized there's more than 4 A's actually. But yeah, like you said, we end part four of the book with a look at the most macro lens, which is the political dimension, which is to say that it's not just that the Western medical system doesn't know how to promote health, because that's what the book's about. It's about trauma, illness, and healing in a toxic.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Culture, that's the subtitle and the theme. But it's not just Western medicine, it's that our entire political system, our entire economic system, like I was just talking about, and our military imperial system, needs to dehumanize people in order to keep going, because it's based on some very inhuman assumptions about what human beings are. So we elect leaders who themselves are disconnected from their humanity based on their own traumatic childhoods, and who have developed winning personalities to cope with that. And then we hire these wounded people to take care of our wounds, and they make our wounds worse, and then we need to hire another wounded person. And we end up feeling very disconnected and powerless. In terms of healing, yeah, it starts at the individual level, although it's not purely an individual phenomenon, given that health and wellness and illness are not just individual phenomena. But I guess the A's, as far as I remember, are authenticity, anger,
acceptance and agency.
Yeah. And then I think we would also add awareness to that. If we could do it again, we would write the fifth one.
Yeah.
So authenticity is a tricky word, because even capitalism wants to sell us what that means. What's Coca-Cola? The real thing, you know? So, and then people are being, you know, real on Instagram and like selling realness and like selling courses to make you more authentic and things like that. And it's a very alluring product, but authenticity is not a product. It's an inner state of alignment. In fact, I'd say alignment is the biggest A for me. That's the one I would add also. So that'd be the sixth. But authenticity is just being who we are and knowing ourselves and knowing our gut feelings and honoring what our own intuitions say. And the biggest category of trauma really is the things that take us away from that early in life, that estrange us or divorce us or alienate us from knowing ourselves on the deepest level, so that we then live our lives trying to please others or prove something about ourselves or deny something about ourselves or trying to get somewhere. Just being ourselves isn't enough. So inviting authenticity in as a value is an important piece of the healing puzzle. One of the principles of healing, anger. Well, one of the facets of being authentic is knowing when to say no. Knowing when you don't like something, knowing when someone gets up and violates your boundaries. So anger, we don't mean going around raging or committing acts of violence. We mean being able to feel the anger that's actually there and not suppressing it, and learning how to say no in a healthy way. And for a lot of people, there's a lifetime of not doing that, so it can feel scary. To use a political analogy, and this is sort of a little, I don't know, it's a little shaky as an analogy, but I'll say it anyway. You know, when one country keeps another people down and occupied and oppressed and silenced and voiceless, of course they're going to be afraid of the anger that's going to rise up against them if they were to give them even an inch of freedom. And our minds are like that too. We push down parts of ourselves. We push things away. We occupy parts of ourselves and annex part of ourselves. And you know, actually, it's not such a bad thing to see the resonances between the personal and the political, because we can see that the energy of it lives inside all of us. And when we push these parts of us away and keep them down, well, they're gonna have an uprising one way or another. Either the anger and the rage will burst through in violence, or in self-violence, self-harm, or our nervous systems will do it for us and the body will say no, which is the name of another one of my dad's books, about how people who suppress their anger tend to get chronically ill. The people pleasers, things like that. So anger is an important piece of the authentic puzzle to reacquaint ourselves with, so it doesn't have to destroy us to get our attention, because it's just trying to get our attention. It just wants us to honor it, you know, just on a basic level. Agency was the third one, was that right?
Yeah, agency.
Yeah, well, agency is responsibility. It's you know, getting that I can't be responsible for the world that created my mind and created my life, but I can be responsible for the mind with which I create my world going forward. I'm not responsible for what happened to me. I am responsible for the lessons I draw from it and the conclusions I draw from it. So if you want to take the political thing once more as an analogy, you know, I'm not responsible for the fact that Hitler tried to kill my people and did kill my great-grandparents and almost killed my grandparents and my father. That wasn't my fault. I didn't do anything to deserve it. Neither did they. What am I responsible for? I'm responsible for how I carry that piece of history with me, for the story I tell about it. You know, I did a debate on my Instagram channel with an Israeli soldier, which is one of the hardest things I've ever done, to sit there and talk to a guy in uniform with a machine gun who's sitting on a base right near Gaza. I don't know what he did that morning or what he was going to do the next day, but probably things that would give me nightmares. But here we are having this debate. And he asked me, well, what is a Jew to you, Daniel? And I told my version of what a Jew is. And he told me his version of what a Jew is. And I said, well, isn't that interesting? You and I have a completely different story based on the same history. We've drawn totally different conclusions. And your conclusions lead you to put on a uniform and pick up a machine gun or maybe get in an airplane and go do what you're doing in Gaza and tell yourself it's the right thing to do. You really believe that. And the lessons I've drawn from the same history tell me the exact opposite, that you need to be stopped. So isn't that interesting that the history hasn't changed? We just have a different version of it, each of us. So that's what I'm responsible for. I'm a free agent in terms of the meaning and interpretations I make out of the raw materials of life. And then I'm responsible for the consequences of those interpretations and the actions I take. So agency is a big deal. And when we've been victimized, there's a part of us that likes to stay the victim.
Yep.
Because when we're the victim, we're not responsible.
Yep.
You can't make me responsible. But responsibility is not a burden. It's actually the access to any kind of freedom. And what was the fourth one?
Acceptance. Did you talk about it?
I didn't talk about acceptance.
Yeah,
and acceptance is a acceptance is a tricky one. Because again, I mean, look, the political is right there on the table. Why don't we talk about it? How are we supposed to accept what's happening? How can you accept that? It's unacceptable. And yet it's happening.
Yeah.
But it's totally unacceptable. And yet me rejecting it doesn't make it any less real.
Yeah.
And me not being able to accept that this is the reality right now actually prevents me from being able to do to stand up in the face of it because I can't look at it. So acceptance doesn't mean tolerating something. It means accepting that at this moment, what's happening is what's happening, and that the past is the past, you know? And I don't know what that has to offer Palestinians in this situation. I do have an idea of what it has to offer Jews who haven't yet let go of their attachment to Israel. To fully accept would be to accept that October 7th was a horrible shock to our systems, that it was a nightmare for the people of Israel, that horrible things happened that day that should never happen. And that it was inevitable based on everything that had happened before. And that if we truly don't want it to happen again, we have to accept the truth of how we got there in the first place. And we have to be able to see that the way Israel and much of the Jewish world is responding to it is guaranteed to lead to much worse in the future.
Yeah.
Until we can accept that whole picture. And acceptance also means accepting contradictions. Some things will never be resolved. There will never be a perfect solution. And there may be some acceptance for Palestinians to do. I don't know. It's not my place to tell Palestinians what they should and shouldn't accept. God knows they've had the world doing that to them for decades. But Palestinians for themselves are going to have to deal with what's achievable, what's not achievable, what do we need to accept right now, all of that. But in no way does that mean tolerate or just shrug or just put up with an intolerable, unjust situation. And it also doesn't mean stop, give up the right to resist. It's actually through acceptance of the full picture that we can then embody our resistance in a way that's intelligent, whether it's in our own lives, you know, trying to be activists for what we want, or politically. You know, the best political leaders are ones who were able to feel the grief and the heartbreak of the way it is and imagine a vision of how it could be and act from reality. So those are the four. Then there's awareness. You need awareness to do any of those. You have to be aware that you're angry. You have to be aware that you're not being authentic. You have to be aware that you have agency, and you have to be aware that there's something to accept. And then I would add my own, which is alignment, because when things are aligned, we really are magnificent creatures. Like, we have so many gifts as people. And when our thoughts, minds, emotions, memories, interpretations, and intentions are aligned with each other, we can actually behave in ways that do honor to our species. And when they're not, boy, oh boy, look out. So looking for that internal alignment and then alignment with something external that is worthy of us, whether that's solidarity with a people or a religious tradition or a moral code, whatever it is, aligning ourselves with something bigger than our own
Thank
egos.
you. And you also work as a chiropractor, as a
A mental
mentor. Yeah.
chiropractor.
So
So
how the.
it's not real chiropractic. That's just a metaphor.
Okay, tell me about that more.
Yeah. Well, so alignment is the basic principle of my mental chiropractic work. If you think of a physical chiropractor, they're looking for alignment in what? In the spine, right?
Yeah.
And what that suggests is that there is an ideal alignment for a human spine. It'll be slightly different for everybody, but there's a basic design to it. And if the vertebrae and the muscles and all of that are, and the nerves are in alignment, then the whole body can function at its best and be itself, be authentic. If it's not, then you're going to have constant nerve pain, or you're not going to be able to lift one leg, or you're going to be in a bad mood or have headaches. So a chiropractor tries to say, okay, what's out of alignment? And let me make an adjustment. I actually don't know much about physical chiropractic. I just used it as a metaphor. I do the same thing with the mind through conversation. I'm not manipulating people's bodies. I'm manipulating their minds through conversation, consensually, at their request. It's an intervention. And I do it while taking a walk with somebody. So I do it by phone usually, because most of my clients are all over the world. Although after we're finished this conversation, I have to drive out to somewhere else in Brooklyn to meet someone for a walk in person, which is always nice. The walking just helps get my blood flowing. I think better when I'm walking. I'm more creative, and I think it helps people too. If you're feeling stuck in your life, movement can't hurt. But the alignment comes from looking at, okay, I'm feeling stuck. That must mean that different parts of my mind are colliding with each other and not cooperating. That's what stuckness is. So I know one thing, but I'm not able to put it into practice. So there's a conflict. I believe one thing, but I'm acting a totally different way. There's a conflict. I have these thoughts, but then I have these feelings and they don't match up. What's going on? And ultimately, for me, the spine of the mind that I want to align everything else with, the vertebrae, is the intention, because our intention is the closest thing to our hearts and our sort of our sense of what we actively want to create in the world and what we see as possible. And our intentions in and of themselves are very powerful, but they have no power if the thoughts and the prejudices and the emotions and the memories and the associations and all of the habits of mind are all jammed up, preventing the intention from getting fulfilled. So it's kind of like, again, if you want to take the political example, the intention, the free-floating theoretical intention of a Jewish homeland sounds good, right? There's nothing wrong with that. Safety, community, togetherness, heritage, all of that. However, that was fundamentally misaligned with a reality on the ground called there's another people there. Now, the most honest Zionists resolved that conflict by aligning themselves with, okay, I accept that there's people there, and I accept that they're not going to want us there, and I accept that we're coming in from the outside. And because my intention is to create a Jewish state and nothing matters to me more than that, therefore, ethnic cleansing and maybe even genocide are justifiable. And we're going to do that because we're superior and we're going to take this land. But we don't blame them for resisting. We expect them to resist. That's what the most honest right-wing Zionist said. But there's a lot of Jewish people and Zionists, including the ones I grew up with, who have been carrying around this contradiction. They've never been able to admit them to themselves that the two things were incompatible, a democratic state and a Jewish state, given the demographics. They haven't been able to accept and fully on board the fact that, just as the Zionists understood, you couldn't create a Jewish state there without kicking out a whole bunch of people and terrorizing them and brutalizing them. Until we accept that misalignment, we can't get aligned with reality. So then if I'm saying what I'm really about in this day and age is freedom, justice, and equality, if that's my intention, well, then it's incumbent upon me to say, okay, if that's really what I'm about, then what pre-existing stories, thoughts, beliefs, prejudices do I have that are incompatible with that, that are going to prevent that from coming about? And a lot of people are holding on to things they don't even realize they're holding on to. And those things make the nice sounding things, freedom, justice, equality, peace, completely impossible. So alignment would be getting it all on the table, looking at it and saying, well, what am I really about? And if you want to say, you know what, fundamentally, I'm about ethnic supremacy. Fundamentally, I'm about the Jewish people and that's it. Well, then at least you're being honest. We know where you stand. But I think for a lot of people, the internal struggle is they can't resolve their humanitarian liberal values with the worldview that their identification with the Zionist project imposes on them. And that creates cognitive dissonance and a lot of distress, which has them lash out at people like me or my dad or any Jew who has resolved it in a different way, which is to say, you know what? I'm not identifying with this Israeli project. I'm identifying with the best of Jewish tradition. I'm going to stand in solidarity with the oppressed, and I'm going to trust that there is a just future that may have to involve, in fact, very likely has to involve, giving up something of what we thought we needed in order to be safe, because it's not making us safe.
Yeah, and I think that's, thank you so much, because I think also it's so beautiful because you mentioned it earlier also, like they have a picture and they don't want to see it in reality. And now you explained, we were talking about the book, you explained the healing for and every step, I think that is so important. And I think like denying is a easy way, because you can project, still project the hate, and you don't need to go inwards. And I think that that's the biggest problem we have, and also here. But something I want to ask you, have you been affected in your work by talking about Palestine? Because here in Sweden, we have a lot of people having really problems when they speak out about Palestine.
So far, there have been no actual consequences. Mm-hmm. You know, honestly, part of me wants to be like, yes, I'm so such a martyr, but I'm not. It's easy for me. My dad and I wrote a book that was a bestseller for Penguin Random House. We have a book contract to write a second one. They haven't at all put any pressure on us to be quiet. I think they understood when, I mean, in fact, we said to them when we signed the book contract, look, when things flare up in the Middle East, you might hear these two authors speaking about it and you may not like it. And they said, we take you as is, you know, they understood. I don't belong to any institutions. I don't work for a university. I don't work for a newspaper. I have a ridiculously privileged life. I'm not apologizing for that. I'm not guilty about it, but I'm very fortunate. I don't have to worry about my coworkers looking at me wrong. You know, I work from home. I write, I make music, I write musicals. Maybe I will learn a few years from now that some theater didn't want to work with me because of my stances on this. There's a lot of Zionist sympathy in showbiz, in Hollywood and on Broadway, you know, but there's also a lot of people who feel differently. So I just don't know if it is affecting my work. I'm not aware of it. I'm not scared of it, but I have it pretty easy, as does my dad. I mean, he's sort of uncancelable at this point. There are people who I've spoken to who feel very, very constrained in their ability to speak about it. And especially when I hear about Palestinian people speaking about how they're not even allowed to express their grief in public. It makes me so angry and so sad, and even more determined to use the ridiculous amount of freedom that I have to say what I can say, because truly there's nothing heroic about what I'm doing, given, if you look at what the price Palestinians in Gaza are paying for just living, it's like the irritation I have to deal with when I see idiotic comments in my DMs or my comment section is laughable.
And do you feel frustrated when you get this comment? How do you answer to that?
I don't get too frustrated, but that's partly because when I'm on Instagram these days, I have developed a persona, a sort of public
Yeah.
facing part of my brand is to be unflappable. So people come at me with the same tired old things and I respond with a joke or an insult if that's what's needed, or a compassionate response. I keep switching it up on them. I never, I try to keep them on their toes. But I do all of that. But what I don't do is get all like, how can you call me that? I expect it. They're just flailing around. Like they're really just like, they're like a cornered rattlesnake that spits venom. They think the world is against them right now. And in some ways it's true, but not for the reasons they think. So I don't take it personally, but I also, when I respond, I'm doing so very self-consciously as a performance. Like I know everyone else is watching and I'm using it as a teachable moment. I want to show people you don't have to be afraid of this garbage. You know,
nice, beautiful.
So it's not, it's like, I'm not saying it's inauthentic, but it is consciously crafted and it's a performance in a certain way for a purpose. It's different than someone walking up to me on the street and calling me a self-hating Jew. I don't know how I would handle that. When I've got my little phone and I can type my witty comments and get a whole lot of likes, I feel pretty insulated. I don't feel particularly threatened.
But it hasn't happened to you that people are screaming.
My brother and my dad were walking in downtown LA last week and someone yelled at them, called them capos, which is the term for Jewish collaborators in the concentration camps, the ones who collaborated with the Nazis. And but no, I haven't had that happen. I've not, only just kind of some hate mail and some nasty comments and, a few sort of very vague threats and stuff like that. But no, I honestly, I've had it very, very, very easy, which sometimes makes me wonder, am I doing enough?
Yeah. Thank you so much. And also thank you for everything today, but also my podcast is always about giving something to people, trying to give a tool or something that they can like go through this inner journey. Do you have some little tool to give someone out there that is very angry, that it's on the comment section on Instagram and like blasting it all out? Can you give a little bit of a tool to people out there to try to stay focused and stay calm?
Yeah, it's this very, very elaborate, specialized technique I've developed called logging off. Just know when to log off.
Thank you.
When you're doing good and when you're not doing any good, my brother always says, embrace the hate if you can, like the hate you get. It's just a sign that you're saying things people don't want to hear. But you also don't have to engage with it. You don't have to be a hero. You really, really don't. You have to sort of gauge what's the benefit. I have to remember to log off, and also remember that part of us gets addicted to the toxins and the nastiness. There's a part of us that's always looking to be right. And so just don't torture yourself. And get with other, the real antidote is to get with other human beings in the room with other human beings, not just online. Online is great, but genuine human connection. I've had a few gatherings in the past few weeks and I can't tell you how medicinal it is. And the only other thing I'd say is if people are feeling genuinely really stuck and in something that they can't see their way out of, whether it's in their personal life right now and that's impacting their activism or the other way around, I'm always available. People can go to my website at walkwithdaniel.com. There's my little shameless plug.
I will also write it in the bio.
Yeah.
Every information. Yeah. Thank you.
And you can book a 15-minute conversation with me for free just to sort of see what you're up to and see, just have get a sense of whether it would be a good fit. But alignment is everything. And trust yourself and realize that only you can only do so much, but also only you can do what you can do. There's no one else who can do what you can do. So you can't do everything, but whatever there is for you to do, I think there's a Jewish expression from some rabbi, I forget who it was, but they said, the task is not yours to complete, but neither is it yours to refuse, or something like that.
Beautiful.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tack till dig som väljer att lyssna på min podcast. Jag hoppas att det här avsnittet gav dig någonting i din resa på väg hem till dig själv. Du som fortsätter lyssna på mig varje onsdag vet att avsnittet släpps klockan 12 på natten till onsdag. Och du som väljer att titta på mig på YouTube släpps avsnittet redan på tisdag klockan 18. Jag hoppas att vi kommer tillsammans göra den här resan och därför betyder det väldigt mycket för mig om du prenumererar på min YouTube-kanal. Där får du även uppdateringar när avsnittet släpps. Ha en fortsatt trevlig vecka och vi ses nästa vecka.